91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour, we continue our South Florida crime history series and track some of the notorious crimes and their perpetrators from the 1930s to 1960. Good afternoon, it's Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper. This is the second of our three-part series with History Miami Museum resident historian Dr. Paul George. The 1930s found South Florida a bootlegger's paradise. The country was dry, but Florida's long coastline and Caribbean proximity made it a booze center. In fact, illegal liquor became as much a tourist attraction as warm beaches. Bootlegger James Horace Alderman was executed in Broward for killing three lawmen, and Hallandale was a mob-run gambling mecca in the 1950s. We'll learn much more in minutes on Topical Currents after the news.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. It's part two of our South Florida crime history series with Dr. Paul George. He's the resident historian at the History Miami Museum and, of course, a longtime history professor at Miami-Dade College.
He's helped conduct some 50 editions of our Topical Currents history quiz programs over nearly two decades and, of course, was a history professor at Miami-Dade College for many years and still does his many, many, many tours. So today we feature the decades of the 1930s through the 60s. And of course, there was lots of criminal activity on the radar.
No telling what went on off the radar. Paul George set us up with South Florida in the year, say, 1930. The Great Depression was gaining steam. Times are tough. So that's always a precursor.
Right. Miami had already been in its own Great Depression since 1926 when the boom collapsed, the hurricane hit, and times got even more difficult, obviously, as a nation slipped into a Great Depression. And I think one of the things interesting is that prohibition enforcement just grew more and more unsuccessful, but then it was finally over, this unsuccessful noble experiment in 1933. But we had a new problem we were grappling with in terms of crime, and that was gambling everywhere. And gambling was very important to the economy of this area, so much so that the police, whether it was here or in Broward County, kind of looked the other way because it was a revenue producer. It was something to bring tourists down, something to keep tourists involved in things. So we were involved in that, but also the 30s, moving from 1930 when the city had a population of 113,000 to a little later on in the decade, there were some sensational crimes that took place in Miami at that time. Not to mention, as we mentioned yesterday, there was a lynching of Reuben Stacy in 1935 in Fort Lauderdale.
Well, go on.
So Miami had its hands full with a lot of issues at that time.
One aspect on the gambling, of course, at that time, if they couldn't gamble here, it was easy for them to go on to Havana and gamble to their heart's content.
And that was one of the considerations, I think, in terms of Miami and South Florida's officialdom. You know, we're going to lose all these people unless we kind of loosen up. So in the words of Sheriff Walter Clark of Broward County, he said, "We pursue a liberal policy here. We give the tourists what they want," you know, which was kind of an open field.
And so Sheriff Walter Clark and his brother, Deputy Chief Bob Clark, had so much corruption, right, in Broward County, and they even owned part of an illegal casino.
Right. It was. They were just kind of flagrant about the whole thing. And as we'll find out when the Kefauver Committee did their investigations, Walter Clark came out as just, you know, this quintessential huckster on the other side of the law.
So interesting. So I want to go back to 33 because that was a big crime. Let's see. February 15th, 1933, during a speech by President-elect Franklin Delano Roosevelt. What happened?
One of the great what-ifs of American history. Franklin Roosevelt had been elected president in November, and we had this long interregnum at that point. He would be sworn in on March 4th. He came down to Florida for a fishing vacation. He was in Fort Lauderdale. He was on Miami Beach. He was in the Astor yacht. The leaders of Miami said, "Mr. President-elect, you know, we really need to have you come here." The banking system was in free fall at that time in this country. Unemployment was 25%. And here was this jovial guy. Nobody quite knew how he was going to approach his task as president. But whatever it was, it couldn't be any worse than Herbert Hoover. So he agreed to come. Bayfront Park, word got out within a couple of days that he would be here. He had poliomyelitis earlier, so he was crippled, and they brought him over in this big, what they called a terse. It was like a convertible, and there was a blacktop road that ran parallel to Biscayne Bay on the eastern edge of Bayfront Park. They brought him over to this amphitheater, which stood just a little bit south of where the Flagler Street extension into the park is. There were folding green chairs. Roosevelt spoke briefly, and suddenly shots rung out. The shots were taken by, or made by, the shooter, a self-styled anarchist, Giuseppe Zingara, an Italian immigrant who had been in Miami for many months, loved to play the dogs. Took a room in a flop house just before the assassination attempt near today's Miami-Dade's Wilson campus. He heard Roosevelt was coming. He went to a downtown gun shop, bought a .32 caliber pistol for $7, and got there early that day. He was about the fourth row, started firing after Roosevelt finished. Roosevelt's talk was typical Roosevelt. It was upbeat despite the fact that the economy is going south fast. Roosevelt said, you know, I've had a wonderful 10 or 12 days here. I'd like to tell you a big fish story, but I have to be honest, I haven't caught any big fish. I have one lament. I've gained 10 pounds. I got to knock this off before I'm sworn in on March 4th. And he finished. And the mayor of Miami, Redmond Gautier, leaned over to him. He was on the stage. Roosevelt was in the car next to the stage. Mr. President-elect, the people of Miami love you. And then the shots rang out. And either a guy in front of Zingara, a guy named Armour, pushed his arm, or a lady next to him who was connected with Florida Power and Light pushed his arm. There's two different accounts of what exactly happened. And he hit five people on the stage, including the mayor of Chicago, who suffered, as it turned out, a fatal wound. He died about 2.5 weeks later.
At
Jackson Memorial Hospital, exactly. And it's one of the great what-ifs. Roosevelt was spared. Anton Cermak, it is said to Roosevelt, as Roosevelt accompanied his car to the hospital, "I'm glad it was me instead of you." And there was always a big plaque at Bayfront Park next to the last band shell, which went up in 1950, with that statement. It was in a metallic plaque. Now it's down on the base where the assassination attempt took place. But it's a great what if.
The statement by Cermak?
Right.
Oh, okay.
And it's still there. It's like a shaped like a manhole cover, and it has his words there. And what's interesting is that the Constitution at that time provided that if a president-elect was not available to be sworn in on March 4th, then the vice president-elect would. We had a guy named John Nance Garner who would have likely been a disastrous president. So, you know, it always harkens back to that old expression that God takes care of orphans, stray dogs in the United States of America. I think it happened that way.
You know, Paul, it's so great when you tell the story, like his speech and, you know, the whole thing. You feel like you're there at Bayfront Park in February of 1933. It is so great.
It was quite a moment. It really was. And it's interesting because, just to digress a little bit, but it's kind of germane to this, Gardner Molloy was there at the speech as a youngster. And Gardner Molloy's birthday is November 22nd.
The day Kennedy was killed.
Right, and Gardner Molloy turned 100 on November 22nd, 2013, which was the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Jack Kennedy.
Now, Giuseppe Zingara, his trial was quite a circus, and his execution was the quickest legal execution in Florida history, in the electric chair.
There was a book that came out many years ago called The 5 Weeks of Giuseppe Zingara from the time of from the time of the assassination attempt till his execution was 5 weeks. And
it's unbelievable.
Unreal. You know, I do have one, besides the monstrosity of what happened, I do have another rub against Zingara. In his spare time in Miami, he was a tour guide. What does that say for me?
Oh, my. No,
I have a predecessor like that.
Well, you know. I wonder how he got the job. I can't imagine.
I do, too.
About 10 years ago, Garrison Keillor brought a Prairie Home Companion down to Bayfront Park at the new amphitheater there.
Right.
And his producers called me here and wanted to know a little bit about that area. And I told them the story of Giuseppe Zingara. And when Garrison did that program, his opening monologue was about... They pretended that John Nance Garner had become president because of what happened at the site there.
Oh, my God. That's interesting. That's interesting.
That's amazing that it was 5 weeks from the time he killed him till the time he was executed.
Well, keep in mind that he pled guilty, first of all, at the courthouse, courtroom 6-1, which has been restored. It's beautiful up there.
He was a young man, too, wasn't he?
He was quite young. I think he was in his late 20s, early 30s. Yeah. He pled guilty to attempted murder. Then when Cermak died, they hauled him back in. He pled guilty to murder. So there really wasn't any long trial. It just was.
So there was no appeal either then?
No, not at all. And then it was said that he said, as he was walking to the electric chair being carried there or whatever, push a button. And it's interesting because we have a transcript of the interrogation by Sheriff Dan Hardy. And, of course, Zingaro spoke with a very heavy accent, spoke English with a very heavy accent. Hardy, as he moves through the interrogation, begins to assume that same kind of broken English accent that Zingaro has. So,
did he have an attorney?
He did have an attorney, and he really didn't care to have one, but he was given an attorney by the state.
Right.
And he pled guilty.
He pled guilty. I think his name was Hawthorne. He was involved in that case.
What was his name?
Hawthorne, I believe, and he was very prominent. But it really didn't matter. I guess he wanted to go to his death. And it's interesting because, see, he blamed this chronic stomach area pain on heads of state. That's where we get the whole anarchist thing. When they did an autopsy on him, it was a diseased gallbladder. And, you know, if you let a gallbladder go on forever.
Weren't there some conspiracy theories about that he may have been working, was it for the Germans or something like that?
Well, there's another one, too, that's interesting, that he was the employee of Frank Nitti, who was a Chicago mobster and associate at one time of Capone. There was a book that came out, a biography of Robert Gore, who was like the boss of Broward County at one time. And the author of that maintains that the hit on Cermak was just what he wanted because Cermak was going after the mob in Chicago. But, you know, that's kind of an out there theory, I think. But some people have embraced that theory.
You mentioned Sheriff Dan Hardy. Give us a little thumbnail about him.
He was a very interesting guy, an Irish Catholic. He was sheriff. He's the guy that created Hardyville we mentioned yesterday in the radio broadcast. He became sheriff in 1910. One of his campaign slogans was, "I arrest suspicious people first, I interrogate them later," to show you the way he saw the law. But he came back.
So guilty until proven innocent,
exactly,
basically?
Exactly. But he came back in the early 30s as sheriff. He was a much older person then. And at that time, he was just overwhelmed by the waning prohibition problems and by gambling. And he didn't even finish his term of office as sheriff. He was kind of nudged out.
We're going to take a break on today's Topical Current. It's part two of our crime series with Dr. Paul George, the resident historian at History Miami Museum. And we'll be right back. Stay with us.
And we're back. It's today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and Dr. Paul George, who I need to tell you has never been indicted.
And does not speak with a heavy Italian accent,
yes,
even though he is a tour guide.
And this is our South Florida crime history series. Paul, we didn't mention yesterday the really famous instance of Horace Alderman, the Gulf Stream pirate, and the unique aspect that he was the only legal execution in Broward County.
Right. He was running. He was a rum runner between Southeast Florida and Bimini and other parts of the Bahamas, bringing back booze. And one time in the process of doing this, he was pulled over by some federal officials, and he picked up a gun and killed two of them, and was apprehended right away and was brought back to Broward. And it was discern through maritime law that he went through the trial process, was found guilty, sentenced to death, that the execution had to take place in a federal facility, the nearest one, which was this old Coast Guard facility on Fort Lauderdale Beach, south of Los Olas Boulevard. And from the time that he was sentenced until his execution there, he found God. And so as he was walking to his death, you know, he was regurgitating passages from the Bible and what have you. And he was executed. And there was somebody who kind of slipped in there, a reporter type, and was able to write in a newspaper a really firsthand account of the execution.
They had an electric chair in this Coast Guard facility?
No, I believe he was hanged.
Oh.
He was hanged.
Oh.
Right. Which would have been the old way. Yeah, because the only electric chair at that point, and at any point, I think, is in Rayford, in Stark, Florida.
So that was considered a crime against the military.
Well, against federal officials, yeah,
right.
Exactly. And that's, I think, the reason why he was assigned to a Coast Guard facility and the reason why the government jumped into it so quickly.
I'm going to go back to Al Capone because he still comes into it in the 30s, right?
He's ubiquitous.
Okay, and we have an emailer. Bill wants to know if you mentioned that he had a secret hideout. I don't think you did yesterday in Redland. It was at Southwest 248th Street and 207th Avenue, known as the Hidden Grove, and the house is still there.
You know something? Thank God for Bill. I've heard that same reference before. I've always maintained that if Al Capone was everywhere people have him at, he would never get any sleep in the 15 years
He wouldn't have been able to do any crimes.
Exactly.
He'd be too busy
so
being
busy.
At the assets.
But God bless Bill on that because that has been pointed out to me before. Whether it really was or not, I don't know, but I've seen the building.
You have.
I have. That's interesting. But, you know, my question would be, why did he need it? Because his home at 93 Palm Avenue was so heavily guarded. It had a guard tower and it had a wall. But
who was he hiding out from? Everybody knew.
Well, most were on his payroll.
Yeah, exactly. So what else did he do in the 30s? And when did he die?
He died of a massive brain hemorrhage in 1947. He just turned 48 in January 47.
So he had 17 good years.
He went to prison.
Oh, that's
well,
right.
Well, not only prison, but he came out with tertiary syphilis.
Right.
And it was said that Al, when he came back, he was out of prison in 1939. He was back at his Miami Beach place in 40. He would sit out by the pool. He had an above-ground pool. Technology at that point wasn't that advanced when he got into swimming pools. And he'd sit out by the pool, and he'd fall asleep with a newspaper across his lap. And he'd kind of wake up and yell, listen to this, where's my Dr. Pepper? Not a very good advertisement for Dr. Pepper soda pop.
No.
But you know, the guards were always around there, too. He had a big cabana in the back, and there's a little waterway behind him that separates Hibiscus Island from Palm Island.
But he really never was involved in that rate of criminal activity here, was it?
This was his vacation home, other than away from that. Right. But what brought him down initially was a lot of the booze that he was touching was coming through here. But this became his home, essentially.
Was he not part of the gambling scene because that was so huge?
It was said that he was, but, you know, Bonnie, it's so hard to document what he did, and I don't think he really did much from 1940 on. I think he stayed around the house.
He probably got tired of all of that.
He certainly had enough money, that's for sure.
So I found this article. It was written by a staff writer, I believe it's on Sentinel, Robert Nolan, called Back in the 30s and 40s, Slots and Stickmen Ruled Broward.
Right.
I mean, and it talks about, it says that because of the large number of banks erected to house the gangsters' loot in Broward-Hallandale, was called the Wall Street of South Florida.
Which is absolutely amazing.
Isn't that incredible?
Well, it was a farming community at that time.
Right, and they said it was an unlikely moniker for a farming community.
Exactly. But, you know, because it was a farming community and below the radar, that's why Meyer Lansky and his brother Jake kind of swept down on that. And they established a couple clubs there where there was gambling, La Boheme and the Colonial. And that's where they had a lot of gambling going on. Meyer then leaves circa 1940 for Cuba to help Batista set up gambling in Cuba, in Havana. And Jake and Jimmy Blue Eyes kind of take control of things in Meyer's stead at that point.
But no locals allowed either.
Pardon me?
No locals allowed in the casinos.
You know, I'm not sure, but I don't think they would have the wherewithal to be in there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was really, these were northern folks coming
down.
The
locals were paid off, but they weren't allowed in the casinos.
Interesting. Yes. The Lansky thing is interesting because, as you know, he was expelled from Israel and comes back to Miami, is hauled down to the Federal District Courthouse, but was never hit with an indictment or a conviction. And he ends up dying at Mount Sinai Medical Center.
Well, I think he lived right off Pine Tree.
Yeah.
And 41st.
He used to walk his dog there.
Yeah.
Right, and he liked to read in the library, the Miami Beach Library, which was in the Collins Park where the Bass Museum is today.
And he hung out at Wolfie's.
Which is not good for a guy with a real cholesterol heart problem, but apparently he did. But it's interesting, when he died in the early 1980s, he came into Mount Sinai. He died of lung cancer, a heavy smoker. And the CEO of Mount Sinai said, would you like some additional security here? And he said, I really don't think I need it. And as he said that, two of these huge guards just emerged from nowhere right at the door.
Oh.
So he didn't need it.
No, he had his own guards.
Yes.
You know, this interesting, just this other thing in this article I found that when that sheriff, Walter Clark, was grilled at a U.S. Senate Crime Investigating Committee led by Kefauver,
right.
They asked him about the gambling and stuff, and he said he was unaware of any gambling in his bailiwick. And so he said the whole audience, the whole gallery erupted in uproarious, you know, laughter, uproarious laughter.
Of course, of course. Well, he had a counterpart down here with the Kefauver thing, Jimmy Sullivan. They were both interrogated by the Kefauver Committee, which was a traveling roadshow to major cities looking at gambling and organized crime. And both Walter and Jimmy Sullivan, who was a very popular policeman, he had a beat down on Southeast 1st Street, either at Miami Avenue or First Avenue. And Jimmy was so adept at whistling, he didn't need a police whistle to stop somebody from jaywalking. He would just use his own devices. But he parlayed his popularity as a Miami Police Department beat cop into a successful run for sheriff. But he had problems. The Kefauver Committee says, you know, we've subpoenaed records on you, your bank accounts, and, you know, you've put away in the last couple of years $70,000-plus in a bank account, but your salary's only $10,000 or $12,000 a year. How do you explain that? And he had no explanation for it. And he was forced out as sheriff.
Eventually. Right?
Yes, yes.
We have an emailer. Tracy wants to know, she said at the beginning of the show, she heard about the lynching in Fort Lauderdale. She wants to know more about that. Now, would you also address the whole lynching situation in South Florida even? Well, mostly it was Northern Florida.
Right.
But Florida's role in lynchings going through the 30s and the 40s.
Right, into the 40s for sure.
Yeah.
The
whole racial situation at that time.
And, of course, the most heinous thing was probably Emmett Till. That's 1954.
Right.
This is really late. Florida had the dubious distinction of being among the leading states in terms of the number of lynchings per year. In a couple of years, they led the nation. The NAACP would monitor all this every year, and they had a magazine, I think they still do, called Crisis. And Crisis would list the lynchings and describe what happened. And it was oftentimes a black youth male with some sort of almost superficial involvement with a white woman.
Right.
He might have whistled. He might have looked too long.
Or he might not have done anything.
Might not have done anything. And suddenly there was this herd of people that had picked him up. And it's interesting how bad news travels so quickly. And by the time he was lynched, and oftentimes it included torture and whatever else, burned, there'd be a mob of people watching this. It was just unbelievable. This was the Piney Woods in Fort Lauderdale. Stacy, the same thing, charged with maybe looking too closely at a white woman. Was lynched there in a wooded area where the expressway runs through today.
And what year was that?
That was 1935. And there was an attempt, first of all, to take him out of there and bring him down to the jail in Miami-Dade County to kind of keep him safe so that, you know, you wouldn't have this mob violence. I mean, not that they really cared for him, but to create some sort of organization for this. And the powers that be, they're going to bring him down here. The car was surrounded. He was taken out of the car and lynched. Yeah,
and what was generally the situation back in the 30s and 40s, you know, for blacks?
It was absolutely horrendous. We see some gains during Reconstruction, which was over more or less in 1877. About a dozen years later, Jim Crow laws set in. Statistics are interesting. There were, because during Reconstruction, Republican administrations really worked in behalf of these freedmen. And they had political positions, and they did vote. And that's why the Ku Klux Klan arose, to terrorize blacks from voting, to put these so-called carpetbaggers in office. We have statistics that are very interesting. If you look at how many people registered to vote, for example, in Alabama in 1890, it's a little bit after African Americans, a little over 100,000. If you look at the stats about 1903, 1904, a little more than 1,000. They've been stripped through all these devices to deny them the vote in the South. And once you take that away, I mean, you really have hobbled a people.
And then, of course, we can look today to what's going
on
with the voter
registration. We see an onslaught right now in that respect.
We're speaking with Dr. Paul George, resident historian at History Miami Museum, and we're talking about crime, well, from 1930 to 1960s. So let's take a break. It's part two. Part three will be tomorrow. Let's take a break, and we'll be right back.
It's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and this is our second part of our South Florida crime history series with, of course, our good friend Dr. Paul George.
long time at Miami-Dade College, a history professor, and he's the resident historian at the History of Miami Museum. Paul, I love this name, Skeegee Cash. Skeegee Cash. Sounds like a song.
Yeah, he was a little tow-headed five-year-old who lived out in Princeton, Florida, a farming community, as we know, off of US 1. The railroad tracks ran parallel to the highway at that point. And he was kidnapped by a man named William Franklin McCall in 1938. And McCall, in the process of kidnapping him, smothered him, either accidentally or purposely or whatever. McCall and his wife, he was an unemployed truck driver, lived real close to what was a general store and gas station that Skeegee Cash's parents ran. And McCall had a suicide note that he wrote for $10,000 for the return of this guy. Even after he knew he was dead, he put the suicide note out. And it's interesting because it had been a few days since Skeegee had been missing, and McCall was at the gas pump at this general store gas station that Skiggy's parents owned, and he said, "Oh my God, what's this down here?" And he picked it up, and it's the ransom note. So that made him kind of suspicious. But even with that, J. Edgar Hoover and 80 to 90 so-called G-men, FBI agents, were down here covering that case. Even with that, he still wasn't hauled in as a prime suspect until the police chief of Miami, of Dade County, said, you know, we got to bring this guy back. They had interrogated him, first of all, and apparently it didn't click for Hoover and the other people. They brought him back in. They broke him down. He confessed to it, and he was taken to trial, brought to trial in the courtroom 6-1, Dade County Courthouse. Courthouse at that point was less than 10 years, was about 10 years of age, and was found guilty and sentenced to death, and he was executed in Rayford.
I was thinking to have 90 FBI agents converge in a place, that probably that got a lot of attention. That would have been unusual for the time.
It was national news because the Lindbergh thing was a few years before, where their young son, very young son, younger than Skeegee, had been kidnapped, had killed, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, the nation was just really on pins and needles about these two things. There have been two books written on it. I've read one of the books. I don't think the other's come out yet on the Skeegee Cash thing. He is buried at a cemetery on Southwest 8th Street, just west of Lejeune Road. I've been out to his gravesite several years ago. But, you know, it was just horrifying. Something like this could happen. And if you looked at William Franklin McCall in court, you know, he was dressed up so nicely in a suit, you know, how could something like this happen? But it just swept through the area. Now, there's a good reason why Hoover was here. The racing season had begun. He loved to bet the horses. And at that point, we had tropical beginning in late November, and then Hialeah, and then Gulfstream up the road a little bit.
When did Gulfstream open?
Gulfstream opened up in the late 1930s, tropical a little bit earlier. And speaking about gambling, a very wealthy Philadelphian was able to get the state legislature to legalize pari-mutuel gambling, a guy named Widener, in 1931.
The Widener Stakes.
Yeah, exactly. And that's when that begins. In 1932, Hialeah is a racing venue. It had happened before that, then it was made illegal. And now they brought it back as something legal.
Explain how they pushed that through the legislature for the pari-mutuel.
Well, a lot of lobbying and a lot of lawmakers beholden, I think, to Mr. Widener.
Each county got the same cut.
Exactly. And that way, in Depression-era Florida, what an inducement that was.
So Alachua County was getting as much as Broward.
Right, right. And Dayton and Broward always felt like they were left out. Exactly, exactly. That was the incentive.
Yeah.
This article says that the gambling boom began in 35 when the state legislature legalized slot machines.
Yeah, and that's a very interesting point. Again, depression-weary Florida. Florida's very small at that time population-wise, less than 2 million in 1940, less than 500,000 in 1900. Here we are at 19.2 million today. But what happened was there, any way to raise revenue, and since Florida was, you know, a large tourist state, why not legalize that? So you had slot machines and grain and food stores, shoeshine stands. You had,
and they were just like Las Vegas slots, right?
Exactly. And they were legal from 1935 to 1937. The legislature met every other year then. So it was they legalized it in 35. They made it illegal in 37 when they met again. But they were everywhere. It's estimated there were 10,000 slot machines operating in Florida during that two-year period.
And then it talks about these clubs that you mentioned, the Boheme,
right,
the Colonial, and the Green Acres.
The Green Acres was another club way out there on the periphery of Dade County. And then there were other clubs that were really interesting, though. There was the La Paloma down on Northwest 7th Avenue as you moved to the outskirts of town. that was raided and wrecked by the Ku Klux Klan in 1937. It was
Why
national
was it raided
news.
By the Ku Klux Klan?
They considered it sinful. Remember now, they pose as law and order. And they said, you know, you got prostitution going on there. There's obviously gambling going on there.
And Christians. I guess they were supposed Christians, too.
Yeah. Well, their definition of, you know, 100% Americanism did not include prostitution or gambling, not to mention people of different races.
Well, yeah, that went without saying.
Right.
I guess I think of them more as that.
Yes. I would.
Yeah.
I would for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what do we go on to next? I mean, there's so much to cover.
Lancaster.
Well, Lancaster is interesting. There was a love triangle crime that, again, was nationally captivating, and it involved some seemingly heroic people. William Lancaster was a great aviator from England, married, and Chubby Miller was a great, as they called him, aviatrix, a woman pilot from England, and they both had these tremendous fly-in solo stories where they, you know, they flew between continents and all. And they got to know each other, and a love affair ensued. And like everybody, they ended up in Miami somewhere in their lives. You know, it's almost inevitable you're going to come down here. We're talking now the early 30s, and Lancaster was really looking for work. I mean, neither of them had work. They were living over just south of Coral Way and just west of Southwest 23rd Avenue in the Shenandoah neighborhood. They were renting a house. The house is still standing. And so they were living there, and Lancaster got a temporary job flying stuff from, legitimate stuff, we think, from the southwestern U.S., Arizona, into Mexico. And so he left. And Chubby Miller then took in a renter, a guy who wanted to write a biography of her, a guy by the last name of Clark. And one thing led to another, and they had a love affair going. Lancaster came back from his temporary job to find this going on, and the first night he was back, Chubby went to bed. So you guys can argue about this, I'm going to sleep. And she did recall a lot of yelling and screaming going on, and next thing we know, there was a shot, and Clark didn't wake up the next morning, you know, gun to his head. And there was a suicide note, but it was later admitted to by Lancaster that he actually wrote the suicide note, and the gun that killed Clark was Lancaster's gun that he had recently purchased. Went to trial, courtroom 6-1, downtown courthouse. Lancaster was treated like a celebrity, so people would wait in line to get seats each day for this court hearing, and they wouldn't even leave for lunch or to go to the bathroom. They didn't want to lose their seat. There were people waiting outside to get in. Long story short, Lancaster was acquitted, and there was this tremendous cheering that went up in the courtroom. And the judge on several occasions had warned people, don't cheer during the courts. This is a very serious situation.
Right.
And they loved Lancaster. The culmination of this whole thing, Lancaster and Chubby went back to England. They broke up. Lancaster says, I'm going to do something nobody's ever done. And this is now 1933. I'm going to fly from England to Australia. Well, his plane went down in the Sahara Desert. He was missing. Nobody knew where he was. He lasted 8.5 days there, ran out of water, kept a diary each day. They found the skeleton, Lancaster's skeleton, and the plane in 1962 or 63.
When did they find the diary? Same time?
Same time, 30 years later. Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing story. Yeah.
Curtis wants to know if the execution that occurred in Broward was where Bahia Mar currently is. He says in those days, the inlet to the ocean was north of where Port Everglades currently is, so it would make sense that a Coast Guard station be located just south of Las Olas.
It indeed was. Oh, it was okay. Maybe 5 blocks south of Las Olas, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join in with a comment or question, please keep these questions in reference to South Florida crime history. Not freelance ones for Dr. George. Our number, 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. Also, email, that might be faster, radio@WLRN.org.
So let's talk about Meyer Lansky.
Right. Meyer, as everybody believes, and there's been so much written on him, was the brains behind so many organized crime initiatives and organized crime groups in his
were
career.
Were they hand in glove with the Italian mafia, or they were very separate entities?
You know, I think
he grew up with Luciano.
Well, I think he freelanced with different groups at different times, because apparently he was so skilled with the pencil that everybody, you know, wanted his input when it came to the finances and what went where and what have you. So in his long career, I think he was with different groups at different times, but never able to nab the guy. Very suave, been several books written on him. I I was hired by a guy named Lacey who did a book on him, Little Big Man. I was hired by him 30 years ago to walk through South Beach and get a sense of what it must have been like when he was there. And it has always been so, I think, captivating to people because he was so elusive. And yet he was there with that little dog of his wife, Teddy, his restaurant tastes, his library, all of that stuff.
Lived very modestly.
Very modestly, yeah. Like me? Who, me? I would do something like this?
Yeah, really.
That type of thing. No flamboyance at all.
But wasn't he about to be arrested when he went to Israel? Isn't that why he went?
I believe he was. And when he came back, he was hauled back into court, but they could never get anything to stick to him. And we've got, there's tapes on some of the local newscasts about, you know, when he's been brought down to the federal courthouse. Yeah, interesting character, very. So he spent his last many years here after he was pushed out of Israel.
Let's see. Joyce wants to know about the tunnels that supposedly exist in Coconut Grove where they brought in liquor from the boats on the bay.
Well, God bless Joyce, but I don't think he really needed a tunnel. The law was on the take. We do know that there were bags, burlap bags, where rum runners would throw this booze on the shoreline after somebody called a spotter, a guy with a flashlight, would flash his light in a certain way, meaning it's safe, but I'm not even sure you needed that. It was just so flagrantly violated prohibition. It was such a joke, especially in this area. But whatever the case is, I just don't know about the tunnels. I think that's pretty far-fetched.
You don't even think there were
tunnels?
I don't
think so. I don't think it was necessary.
Or a hideout for Al Capone in the Redlands.
I don't think so.
Okay, we're speaking with Dr. Paul George. It's part two of our crime series. He's the resident historian at History Miami Museum, also a professor at Miami-Dade College for many, many, many years. He teaches classes at the museum as well as conducts his walking, boating, bus, bike, and train tours at History Miami. So you can always find out about that at historymiami.org. Let's take a short break and we'll be right back.
It's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, and the illustrious Dr. Paul George. It's our South Florida crime history. This is episode two. We'll also be doing one tomorrow, so you might want to tune in then as well. Ray in Miami, you're up. Hi.
Excuse me. Hi. In the 40s, in the early 40s, I worked, Dr. George mentioned Green Acres and Colonial Inn. I worked at Colonial Inn and also a club, I think it was called the Little Palm Club.
Yes,
I just wondered. Right. I wondered if he had any information on it.
Well, it's interesting because there was the Palm Club, which stood close to where the Royal Palm Hotel stood, and that would be near the bay, a couple blocks south of Flagler Street, and that was a big gambling club in the late 30s, early 40s, you know, a very showy place. But the Little Palm Club, or the Little Royal Palm Club, stood over about a little bit in front of where the Herald Building was until it was razed a couple of years ago. And it, too, reportedly offered gambling as well as being just a nightclub.
It was on Biscayne or east of Biscayne?
Yeah, it would be east of Biscayne Boulevard, somewhere around a little bit south of 15th Street. Very close to where we are right now, in fact.
Where the interchange now to go over the...
A little bit north of the interchange. A little bit north of the interchange, yeah. Across from where the Sears Tower would be, in that area there, behind the Boulevard Shops. But yes, that was a very active club. There were night spots, other night spots in that area, too. That had a particular reputation for gambling, if you went into the back room or some such place.
Mm-hmm. I never saw the gambling because we were in a room and played, but I saw the doors shining, you know, big mirrors, floor to ceiling, and people disappeared.
<You know>? They went somewhere.
Well, yeah, they went somewhere, but I understand that it was a very active place.
And by the way, I went to school with a nephew of Capone.
Oh, boy.
University of Miami. He was very quiet. Very nice, and I don't see why he shouldn't, but he used the name Capone, which was interesting.
Yeah, it really was.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Capone's son actually dropped Capone as a last name, and it was his middle name was Francis. He became Albert Francis just because he was so dogged by that name.
Well, sure.
Yeah.
Osvaldo wants us to speak about the cocaine cowboys in South Miami, but Osvaldo, that's... tomorrow.
That's
show.
Tomorrow. And that's,
yeah, we also have a caller about Murph the Surf. That would be
that tomorrow.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some very interesting crime figures coming
up. So we're
up.
Trying to stick to the 50s, the 40s, the 30s.
Well, I'm very interested in, Paul, he's listed this, the clinking brassieres.
Oh, boy.
I'm always interested in brassieres.
What a case that was. It's 1950 Miami, and several women who worked for what was then called Southern Bell in downtown Miami. If you made a long-distance call at that time, you had to put coins, quarters, and what have you in a phone. And several women worked in an accounting room where they would count the money. And they became collaborators and walking out with a lot of money. And the key was, at least on the part of one of the women, wearing a greatly oversized brassiere where they could stuff a lot of quarters, oftentimes in these little envelopes that held them. And they would walk out each day from
work. You mean
those
little rolls that you get?
Yes, they were rolled up, exactly. Yeah. And they would walk out each day. Inevitably, a falling out occurred between some of them. One of them had a policeman boyfriend, and she got into a fight with another. And there were about four or five of these women collaborating in the counting room. And she decided to spill the beans to her boyfriend. So to speak, yes. And that opened up, that just opened up this case. One estimate is that in a period of somewhere around a year, they had walked out with $100,000 in coins. But that's just an estimate. And that's a lot of money.
In dimes.
In dimes and quarters. Yeah, in quarters in particular. So it went to trial. They had an attorney. Attorney's name was Rainwater. And Judge Willard, who was a really tough judge, was the judge. He sentenced them to a year. They were found guilty. But he gave them a suspended sentence. But I think the interesting thing is how they paid off their attorney in quarters. So, but it was the headlines to see. It was interesting because, you know, Miami was so much more Victorian and politically correct at that time in terms of things that, you know, dealt with sex or whatever. And so the headlines were always guarded, but there was always this double entendre about it. You know, you could almost see through the headlines what they were writing about. But it went on for several days in the courthouse, and the ladies would walk out after a day of hearings, and they would have newspapers in front of them shielding their faces and all that. It was really the talk of the town. Somebody, in fact, mailed in a payment to Southern Bell, but he wrote Southern Bra Company, and it was delivered.
Maybe they stole that because they were strapped.
Okay, John wants to know, he says there are many crimes that happened in Interama, the area between North Miami Beach and East 135th Street and Northeast 151st Street near the FIU Biscayne Bay campus. Do you know, I remember that Eileen Wuornos, but that was much later.
Yeah, and the Don Arano thing is much later, too. Yeah. He was up in that area, too. That's much later. Interama itself was this thing that never happened, 1951 and 1975. The idea of creating a permanent exhibition of different countries in the hemisphere, putting their goods up there, their industrial output, it just never happened, but it was in that area.
Yeah. So, John, tomorrow we'll probably get to some of those crimes.
We should, yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And let's move along to line two. Michael in West Palm. Hi.
Hey, how are you doing today, sir?
Good. Go ahead.
Oh, well, just real quick, the screener questioned if it was a crime or not, but I just wanted to see if you had any comments on Henry Flagler's crime history. As it relates to him, you know, burning out the African-Americans that lived over on the town of Palm Beach. There's not a lot of bad things said about Flagler, but from what I understand, you know, bootlegging and a lot of illicit. I just wanted to get your thoughts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in West Palm.
Well, we understand that the community there, I think the area is called the Sticks, STYX, was burned and burned down, and our understanding was that some white folks were complicit in it. I'm just not sure that Flagler was complicit in that. We know he had a lot of both white and African-American workers. He did have a problem down in the Florida Keys in that there was a congressional investigation of how he acquired some of the workers to build the Overseas Railroad, and there were accusations of peonage and whatever, but the congressional committee findings did not punish him or find him guilty of anything that was considered illegal, but he was always under suspicion in terms of that workforce. But I just can't really say much about his role in the West Palm Beach thing. My answer would be, why? Why would a guy who was worth over $100 million at that time, you know, want to be involved in something like that? It just doesn't make sense, especially as an older man, but what have you on that. But I understand the firing of part of the black settlement there was probably something that whites were responsible for.
Okay, Michael, thanks.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, Michael. We have an emailer. Gina wants to know if Hallandale Beach was a known location for members of the Mafia. Family lore is that her grandfather traveled with his family, wife and children, following the horses from the 40s to the 60s, was involved with the boys. The children would go to Bible college for schooling during the season. Do you know anything about Tom Palmer?
Well, I don't know about Tom Palmer, but clearly mob figures did visit those clubs that the Lanskys had established.
Right.
And they gambled there, they enjoyed there, they saw compatriots there. There's no doubt about it. And it's a great irony because that was a completely undeveloped, tiny farming community. But Lansky, in his own sort of genius way, said, well, this is a perfect place to put these clubs. You know, they're way off the beaten path, and this is a good place for them. But word got out that you could go there and have a good time.
Was the It Club part of that?
I don't know.
You don't know?
I don't know.
This says that the police directed traffic outside and escorted casino managers to the bank.
Jeez. The Wall Street of South Florida.
With the Mafia and the casinos, though, wasn't it sort of understood among the mob that this was an open city and not to be doing any hits down here because it would overturn the apple cart here as far as the gambling?
Well, it could, but also the 60s, one of the conventional jokes was if you saw a body floating in Biscayne Bay, it was somebody who was part of a mob family. And there was a guy named Hank Messick who was writing at that time, a crime writer. He said that Miami was the most corrupt city in the United States.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. This was a
well, back in the 40s and 30s.
Right. Back in the 30s, you didn't have that problem to the degree you might in the 60s. But you know, the quotes are unbelievable. J. Edgar Hoover said in 1949, if I could arrest every mobster at the intersection of Collins Avenue and 23rd Street on the beach, I would eliminate organized crime in America.
Is that where the Wolfies was? Or is that 21st?
Actually, the Wolford Hotel was at 24th, which was mob-owned during part of its lifetime. And so I think a lot of mobsters stayed in the Wolford. Wolfies would be down at 21st. Yeah,
okay.
Real close to it, though.
Yeah. Wow, that's amazing. Well, do we have time for...
Let's quickly. Francisco, Miami. Francisco, we're short on time. Hurry up.
Thank you.
Do you want to ask your question, Francisco? We're short on time.
I guess I scared him off. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, it's our crime series, and tomorrow is part 3. We've been doing part 2 with Dr. Paul George. He's the resident historian at History Miami Museum. Teaches classes there. You can find out about them at historymiami.org or 305-375-1621. Also about all of his many kinds of tours. Any mode of transport will do. Thank you, Paul. It's been great.
He hasn't been doing water ski tours.
I'm not real good at that. Yeah, that'd be difficult.
Okay. But
thank you.
And we hope you enjoyed our special this hour. We certainly did. Our lead producer is Richard Ive. Technical direction today from Michael Stock. Polly Landis is associate producer. Peter Mertz is posting our online content. And as always, it's easy to download free audio archives of each of our programs from our website. That's WLRN.org. Follow the radio link. Also, the Topical Currents Facebook page and iTunes podcast. We're back tomorrow for our crime history series. We'll wrap it up with celebrated South Florida activity in the late 20th and early 21st centuries. Quite a handful, of course, such as the Jacques Mosler murder, the Miami River Cops, the Cocaine Cowboys, and Yahweh Ben Yahweh.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about him. He had the football player involved there.
Yes.
Pro football player.
And Paul's a walking encyclopedia.
Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman, thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned for Here and Now, next on Where Else But NPR News.